Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today we'll be interviewing Alex Welling, who is challenging the controversial chair of the Cajon Valley Union School District, Jim Miller. And just in time for Halloween, we'll have some East County ghost stories for you today. So stay tuned for the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, where East County matters. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. And today, my very special guest is Alex Welling. He is a candidate for the Cajon Valley Union School District Board of Trustees. Alex has
a master's degree in legal studies,
as well as bachelor's degrees in political science and government. He's currently a communications manager of wildfire resiliency for San Diego Gas and Electric Company. He's been a public communications officer for SANDAG, a field director for the American Action Network, and he's also served on the City of Chula Vista's Board of Ethics. He is a conservative running to challenge Cajon Valley's board chairman, Jim Miller, who is also a Republican. Alex says he's concerned about respecting parents' rights, transparency, improving test scores, and holding staff accountable. So, Alex, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I wonder if you could start by telling us a little bit more about yourself. You know, do you have any kids? And what got you engaged and concerned about what's happening in this school district?
Yeah, absolutely. So as far as a little bit of background, you know what, I grew up in between homes in Chula Vista and El Cajon. I've got family in both cities and, you know, got married, gosh, when was that? Back in 2017. And, you know, my wife and I were living down in Chula Vista, had just had our first child, decided to move back into kind of the East County area. Right about now, we're on the border of Spring Valley and Rancho San Diego, kind of right off of Hamishaw on the 94. And prior to moving, you know, I realized our son was starting to get of age to start going to school. And, you know, my wife and I were both raised in public school. So it's definitely important to us to make sure that they have a quality education and have that kind of same experience that we did. And I was concerned about test scores. You know, test scores were extremely low to the point where family and friends who live in different districts were trying to tell us that, hey, maybe you should put our address down and you could send our kids to that district, which is not necessarily the most ethical thing to do.
You know, we first raised alarm bells about the test scores that were declining in this district several years ago. And when I tried to ask the superintendent, David Miyashiro, who's still there, he became very angry and said, Miriam, they're measuring the wrong metrics. And I said, sir, they're measuring math and English. Well, it's the wrong metrics. And unfortunately, it's gotten even worse since then. And thank you for sending the latest stats. It's really, I think, disturbing to see that they're now, Cajon Valley now ranks in the bottom 50% statewide overall for test scores, with only 34% in math and 49% in reading. That is down sharply from 2014, when they were around 70% in math and somewhere around close to 85% in reading and language arts. This, even though spending rose sharply and is higher than the state medium, so they're spending more money, but it's not showing up in the academics, you know. What happened and what would you do if you were elected trustee to get those test scores up?
You know, you bring up a really good point. Spending goes up, test scores go down. So I think the real question is, where's the money going?
Yeah.
You know, I've told several people and you know, anybody that is willing to hear me speak that the first action that I want to do as a member of the Board of Trustees is call for an independent audit. Because we need to be able to answer that question. Where are our tax dollars going? And why are test scores continuing to tank? You know, just over the last year, I have seen and been made aware of and actually really dived in and looked at where tax dollars are going. And they're not going to the students. Just several months ago, I think it was actually 2 or 3 months ago, the district held a celebration for teachers, a welcome back ceremony, which I'm all for. You know what? We need to celebrate our teachers, but mm-hmm. we also need to make sure that they have the resources that they need to be able to succeed and provide our students with the tools and resources that they need to lead successful and good lives later on in life. But let me tell you this, the bill for that event was to the tune of somewhere around $360,000 for a 1-day event. They spent just over $100,000 on the Viejas Arena, about $150,000 on food. They spent about $14,000 on fireworks and somewhere in the tune of, I think it was like around $10,000 for a sand artist to come in.
Yeah, this is like a continuation of, you know, issues we've seen over and over. Back in 2019, Alex, we reported about, you know, complaints that the district had spent over, I guess it was from 2014 to 2019. 2014, by the way, is when Miyashiro became the superintendent, the last, you know, time they had high test scores. They had spent over $500,000, $576,000 on marketing and promotional videos. And, you know, we did a comparison and no other district nearby had spent more than $15,000. So, I mean, this is like 20 times, I don't know, you know, huge discrepancy there. And yet, you know, teachers are being told, buy your own supplies and pencils in a lot of cases. So there does seem to be something, you know, amiss maybe in the priorities there, I would say.
I was just going to say, I 100% agree. It really comes down to asking the question, what are the district's priorities? You know, that money could have been spent to, like you said, it could be providing pencils, colored pencils, notebooks, paper, activities for the children. You know, so teachers aren't spending money out of pocket when they don't have to. But, you know, unfortunately, there's also the production aspect of these events where, you know, you can tell looking at the YouTube videos that it was a produced video and it's put on to generate clicks. And
it's about boosting student morale. I mean, there's some of that. I'm not going to say there's no benefit
to
the videos, but it just seemed like an awful lot of money and maybe they could have gotten it done for a lot less, you know.
And there are ways to do that. There certainly are. And it just raises some red flags when we're spending that much money on a single day event. Yeah. And we can better invest that money into our students while still giving our teachers, you know, the appreciation, the team building activities and everything else that they deserve, because you know what, they are the people who are with our children for 8+ hours a day. And they have hard jobs and it's important that we recognize that. But at the same time, we need to understand the purpose of the district. The purpose of the district is to make sure that our children have the tools and resources that they need to succeed later on in life.
Yeah, for sure. I wanted to ask you your views about the district's World of Work program, which David Miyashiro rolled out, and he has touted it all over the country. They've sold this to other districts. You know, essentially it's teaching kids occupational skills, you know, bringing in experts in different fields to teach them about potential occupations. But, you know, you got to ask, is this coming at the expense of learning reading and writing and mathematics? What are your views on that? Can you do both? Can you do both, or do they need to take a second look at that program?
I think you can do both. I think the World of Work program in concept is good. You know, we need to make sure that kids have, you know, real world experiences, real world knowledge. You know, I remember looking back at my education, the requirements that I passed chemistry and algebra 2 and physics and all those types of things. And I've never used it before in my life. I have learned more being on the job in 1 day than I have elsewhere. So it's definitely important that we bring the occupational knowledge back into the classroom rather than just, you know, the math, reading, writing. Obviously, that's critically important, but we also need to make sure that they have the tools to succeed later on in life. My question is, what business does the district have getting into lending money to a private foundation with the hopes of possibly generating a profit later on down the road? Because essentially my understanding of the makeup is there's the district. The district is taking taxpayer money. They are loaning it to the World of Work Foundation, and the World of Work Foundation goes out into the world, I guess you could say, the nation, and tries to sell this curriculum with a contractual obligation to make sure that, you know, a certain percentage of proceeds go back to the district, hopefully to make a profit there. But there's an issue with that. Just one example happened earlier this year. The World of Work Foundation requested a loan of over $300,000 to put on a conference for its curriculum, and basically inviting teachers, staff, superintendents, educators from across the nation to come to this conference in an effort to promote it, to sell it. And the foundation was required per the contract to repay the district the $300,000 plus within 60 days. And that was back in March. So the money was due in May, and the district still has not seen a return on their investment. They haven't even received payback of the loan. So the question is, where did that money go?
Very troubling. So that's maybe what the audit might show us.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good idea. You've talked about wanting to see more respect of parents. Alex, can you give us some examples of cases where you believe the board has been disrespectful to parents, or in particular, the board chairman, Jim Miller, your opponent in this race?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I don't want to focus too much on Jim during this interview because I really want to stay focused on the issues. But, you know, having talked to parents throughout the district thus far, and, you know, I've only been in this campaign for a couple months, but the sentiment remains the same. Parents don't feel that they're respected. Their input, their opinions are respected. You know, when they get up and they speak to the board, it seems that the board is distracted. They're just kind of there to hear, but not really listen. You know, I've heard that, you know, board leadership has even commented on parents being the peanut gallery. You know,
we saw the other night that a former board member, Jill Bartow, came to speak, and you know, the chair made some comment about, oh, you don't even live in the district anymore, or words to that effect. And I don't know, you know, we've seen when kids came before them concerned about gun violence, him popping on his NRA hat and, you know, touting his, you know, beliefs in gun rights, but not really offering sort of anything. I get, you know, he's a Second Amendment guy. A lot of people are, but it just seemed like it wasn't validating the concerns of children at a time when there'd just been a mass shooting. You know, perhaps he might have at least listened respectfully, or perhaps offered some other solutions, you know, that might help make schools safer. But
and that's a reflection on leadership. You know, leadership requires the ability to have respect. To have respect for people that you don't agree with, you don't even maybe you don't even consider yourself possibly having any sort of agreement with them in the future, but still being able to sit down and listen and have a civil conversation. You know, I remember reading your article about that board meeting in particular, and you know, I am also a Second Amendment guy as a conservative Republican, but that is not the time or place for that type of action.
It begs the question, though, Alex, if you're not for restricting access to guns, do you have other ideas for making sure that schools are safer for the children, you know, in this era of so many mass shootings?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's, if you look at just the historical record, most of these mass shootings happen at soft targets. Places where the perpetrator knows that there will be little to no security. So making sure that, you know, we have armed officers at schools, making sure that you know, I'll go so far as to say I personally believe that teachers should have a right to carry if they, you know, pass certain requirements. If they're able to get their CCW, their concealed carry permit, maybe go through some additional training since they are going to be potentially dealing with a chaotic, hectic situation and they're going to be trusted to carry a firearm. Maybe there's some additional training that could be applied there so they're able to operate under that level of stress. But I think that that's also a conversation that needs to happen with parents, law enforcement, and other stakeholders. It's not a decision that I can make just by myself.
Yeah, sure.
Because my job as a board member is to listen to the concerns of the community and try to figure out a solution that best meets the needs of everybody. I don't believe that banning guns is the answer, but at the same time, you know, being able to involve members of the community into a process to where everybody kind of reaches a consensus. I know we're not going to be able to please everybody at the end of the day, but making sure that the public has a voice in the process.
And so what whether about it's better mental, maybe better mental health screening, mental health counseling to maybe try to identify troubled students before it reaches that point?
Yeah, there always is that option as well. You know, the mental health crisis is kind of the unspoken pandemic that we're dealing with right now in the United States. And it is more critical than ever. You've seen with, you know, previous mass shootings, these guys have gone through background checks. They've gone through all the federal requirements. They've done everything, but they're still able to get their hands on weapons, whether legally or illegally. So mental health is important, but I think it's more of an education in removing the stigma of mental health awareness. Because, I mean, just going to a therapist, some people aren't comfortable telling their friends or family that they're going to see a therapist. We need to be able to remove that stigma and make it more normal. You have a doctor checkup every year, every 6 months. Why not have a mental health checkup at the same time?
Good point. Well, as well as I think cracking down on bullying, because so many of these kids who wind up, you know, becoming mass shooters have often had a background of bullying. We certainly saw that at one of the local high schools some years back where there was a mass shooting here in East County. One of the two had been a victim of bullying, apparently, and it wasn't really addressed. So there is a lot, you know, beyond many people would support, you know, gun control, but for those that don't, there's certainly many other options besides just, you know, doing nothing. On another subject, at the last meeting, we heard a lot of parents upset that the board was basically seemed to be ignoring their pleas to allow public input in the review of the superintendent, David Miyashiro. As you know, as we've discussed, there have been some controversies about him, not to say everything is bad. I'm sure he's done some fine things, but there have certainly been a lot of controversies. And yet the board wants to handle, you know, renewing his contract behind closed doors with no public input. Do you believe the public voices should be heard in determining whether to renew his or any other superintendent's contract?
Absolutely. And you know, the current bylaws state the public should be involved in that process, which is why it's so concerning that they're trying to change the bylaws, basically cut the public out of the process. You know, for years, you know, going back to when Jill Bartow was on the Board of Trustees, she had been pushing, per the bylaws, for an official evaluation process, you know, where there's goal setting and it's taken to the public and the public has an opportunity to weigh in on what those goals should be for the next year. And that just hasn't happened all the way up until today, to the point where, you know, board leadership is saying, oh, well, we renewed the contract, so that counts as his official evaluation. Just kind of skirting the bylaws and not maintaining any level of accountability for district staff. And let me make it abundantly clear. The role of the Board of Trustees is not only to look out for the best interests of the children that they're serving, but also to hold staff accountable. And that has not been happening. In fact, it seems almost as if, you know, the superintendent kind of has control over the board in this sense. So that needs to change. That relationship needs to flip. You know, if you are any CEO of a Fortune 500 company and your profits were tanking for 5 years, that board of directors would fire you.
Like, sure. No question. At least demand some changes, you know, something, but not just saying, great job, let's rubber stamp, give you a raise, you know.
Exactly. And you know what? We have one of the highest paid superintendents in the state of California.
Yes, he is.
So why are test scores continuing to tank?
A very good question, Alex. And we'll look forward to hopefully finding some answers one of these days.
Me too.
On another issue, we have seen in some school districts, both nationally and locally, kind of a new wave of controversies over things like trying to restrict the teaching of critical race theory, or basically, you know, history of racial issues in this nation, as well as book bans and, you know, restricting counseling or services for LGBTQ students. So I just wanted to see where you stand on some of those controversial issues.
Yeah, absolutely. You know what, the book bans, I'm not the biggest fan of that term, just because it's not necessarily what's going on. It is more along the sense of, you know, removing material that's not appropriate for children at elementary school age.
No age limits, so really, rather than barring it, just saying maybe something that might be okay at 16 isn't okay at 10, you know.
Just like they have movie restrictions at the movie theaters. But, you know, my rule of thumb is, you know, if it's pornographic, it doesn't belong in the classroom. If I can't read it out loud in a public, if I can't show it in public, or if I can't read it in public, it does not belong in the classroom. And that's it. It's that simple.
And how about the other two issues? The critical race theory. Critics of it would say that it's sort of whitewashing history a bit when you have, you know, the governor of Florida saying, hey, slaves benefited from slavery. You know, we shouldn't teach about the bad side of slavery. Does that go too far? You know, is this something that, you know, well, I'll leave that open-ended for you to answer the question on that one.
When it comes to CRT, critical race theory, I think the operative word there is theory. It is not a proven, academically proven subject, I guess you could say. And in many cases, it seeks to do the opposite of what it's trying to create, I guess you could say, in the sense that, you know, it's trying to bring sense to racism and bigotry and everything else. But at the same time, it also separates people into classes. You know, we are the United States of America, the key word there being united, and we are all free. We all have the same rights. And it's important that we focus on the principle of equality rather than diminishing somebody's experiences, somebody's education, somebody's opportunities based on the color of their skin or, you know, where they're from. It's just simply unfair. And rather than judging people based on the color of their skin, we should be looking at who they are as individuals.
Do we not run a risk, though, of repeating, you know, sort of the wrongs of history if we don't teach about it, whether that's the Holocaust or slavery? Do we not need to teach it? Sure. Not saying that it's to diminish white people, but, you know, just having kind of an unvarnished view of what actually happened to Native Americans in this country, for example, Black people.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, at least in my experience growing up and going through, you know, the public education system, all those items were taught. I learned about all the bad things. And, you know, if you don't learn about history, you're doomed to repeat it. And I definitely think that those things need to be taught. And we especially should not censor those things. You know, I've heard calls that we need to censor certain dark parts of United States history when it comes to slavery, and that's just not acceptable, or certain dark parts of World War II and the Holocaust, and that's just not necessary. I mean, look what's going on in Israel right now.
Tragic.
It breaks my heart what's happening, and it's just a lack of understanding of a lack of accurate understanding of history. And if we start sanitizing and censoring certain pieces of it, people aren't going to see the full picture, and it leads to what is happening right now in the world right now. And
yeah, very, very well put. Who are your principal endorsements, Alex? Or is it earlier? Do you have some yet?
I do have some. You know, I have a number of current and former board members throughout the East County area, East County Parent Alliance, Santee Students or Santee Parents for Choice. Mm-hmm. I am very pleased and also honored to announce that before our call, I had a wonderful meeting with former supervisor Diane Jacob, and she has offered her support to my campaign as well as her endorsement.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. I have to be honest, it was a humbling experience to be able to meet her in person.
She is a former educator herself before she was a supervisor. Exactly. So,
exactly. So I'm looking forward to having her support and her guidance.
Yeah.
I mean, 17 years on the school board and another 23 on the county board of supervisors. And, you know, she kind of had this approach to governing that I really admire and I want to emulate, which is a community-based approach. It's, our job is to serve the people.
Yeah, I've seen her, stand up against, even people that had given money, say speaking at a Chamber of Commerce event and speaking against an organization that had given the Chamber a lot of money. She once told me that if you cannot look your biggest donor in the eye and tell them you're voting against them because something is bad for your constituents, then you shouldn't be in public office. So, say what one will about Mrs. Jacobs, she certainly had, I think, ethics, which is so often lacking in politicians today. So you were on an ethics board, but let's hear your views on, are there ethical reforms needed in this district?
I think that there's certainly some transparency reforms, making sure that the public has an idea of what's going on, when it's going on, and making sure that they also have a voice. So much of my career to this point has been focused on public engagement and public policy process, let's call it that, whether it's, a multi-billion-dollar infrastructure project or, a housing project or something like that, whether it has to go through the environmental impact report process, if it has to go through the scoping review, making sure that the people who are going to be most impacted by these projects have a voice and a say in what the end result is going to look like. So it's going out into the community, it's knocking on doors, it's inviting them to public open houses. It's making sure that, they have they don't just feel like they're involved in the planning process, but to actually have them involved in the process. So that's what I want to bring to the Board of Trustees, is that level of involvement and engagement and making these meetings more accessible so more people can attend, more opportunities to provide comment.
Are they still not putting videos up on their site? They do videotape the meetings, but you have to go in the office and ask for them or something, I've heard.
My understanding is that you have to go in, you have to put in a request, and I think they only hold on to it for a few months. And then it just gets archived. And I'd assume at that point you have to put in a Public Records Act request.
Yeah, I got to say here, I got to throw in for the benefit of our listeners out here, or viewers if you're watching this on the site, that we ran into issues with this a few years ago. We kept asking for tapes of public meetings. They weren't providing them. Every time you'd go in the office, there was an excuse why they couldn't turn it over. So we finally sent a reporter in to start taping them ourselves. And they actually threatened to arrest our reporter for taping a public meeting. That's how much they didn't want transparency. They told him he had to go in the back under the noisy air conditioner where it wouldn't turn out. And we actually had to get an attorney, Corey Briggs, shout out to Corey Briggs, to send a letter on our behalf pointing out just how illegal this is. It's California. You have a perfect right to, record any public meeting unless it's, somehow disruptive, which they claimed it was. And it was a recording device the size of a cell phone, sitting on the seat next to my reporters. There's no way, it was just, they just didn't want recording going on. So it they kind of have a long history of, I don't understand why. They should be very transparent and want the public to see what's going on and want to encourage public input. We just had someone from a Lakeside school board attend this last meeting. And, this person mentioned to me how appalled they were to see how it was conducted. It was so different from their school board meeting where, the public is generally respected and treated quite differently. So I just thought that was an interesting observation. But Alex, what else would you like, voters out there to know about you that I haven't specifically asked about? And also, where can they find more information on your candidacy?
Yeah, absolutely. Residents, if you're in the District 5 or Area 5 of El Cajon Union School District, you can go to www.wellingforschoolboard.com, all spelled out. You can also find me on Facebook and Instagram. But really, at the end of the day, my campaign is about the children and making sure that parents have a voice in the process, making sure that parents know what is going on at the school board, making sure that parents know what's going on inside the classroom. And really designing this district around the students, making sure that they have the tools, the opportunities, the resources to be able to live successful and good lives.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, that is my goal. You know, this is a nonpartisan race. I am Republican. I am conservative. I am a Christian. I'll be the first person to say it. But, you know, when I look at my kids, I have my son's turning 4 in just a few weeks. My daughter just turned 2. We have another one, another boy on the way in March. When I look at them, I want to make sure that they have the best opportunities presented to them, especially when it comes to their education. I'm willing to fight for that. And I'm willing to fight for your children too, because at the end of the day, these children, they're our future. They are going to take care of us when, you know, we're old and retired and, you know, we got to hand the reins to them at some point. And I want what's best for all of them. I honestly don't. It doesn't matter to me if you're Republican, if you're Democrat, what your skin color is, what your background is, what your income level is, what your gender identity is. I want to make sure that your child has the best educational opportunities possible, period.
That's very reassuring to hear. And Alex, what is your website if people want to go find out more about you?
Absolutely. It is www.welling, W-E-L-L-I-N-G. forschoolboard.com.
Very good. And we are, of course, nonprofit, nonpartisan. And so we'll certainly be happy to interview any other candidates who may come forward in this race or for any of the other seats on the Cajon Valley District. So, you know, stay tuned. The race is early. But Alex, I really want to thank you so much for taking the time to come on here and join us on the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ. These are really important issues. I don't think there's anything more important than, you know, the education and the well-being of our children. So thank you for caring.
Thank you so much. I appreciate being here.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
We have a special treat for you today for Halloween, some local East County ghost stories. East County has many reportedly haunted places. There are many stories of ghost soldiers haunting the former Army barracks in Campo, the final home of the famed Buffalo Soldiers Cavalry Brigade. The old Julian Hotel's original proprietor from the 1800s reportedly haunts the establishment, startling guests in his former room who have claimed he's even tried to climb into bed with them. Out at the old Vallecito stagecoach station, the ghost of a bride who never made it to the altar and died along the trail reportedly roams the premises searching for her lost love, clad in the wedding gown in which she was buried. And out along Lakeside's Wildcat Canyon Road, if you see a woman beckoning to you to follow her off the road, don't go. Witnesses have claimed she turns toward her victims to reveal no face at all, a dark specter intent on luring motorists off an embankment to their deaths on a roadway where many people have died. But the most spirited area in our region is the Anza Borrego Desert, according to many detailed stories of ghosts that reportedly haunt those lonely trails, mountains, and washes in that harsh, forbidding terrain. Storyteller Cactus Jim has written, "Many travelers, prospectors, and adventurers have gone into the desert never to return or be seen again. Others have returned with gold nuggets and treasures so rare that we could only dream of being so lucky ourselves. Desert lore, stories, and quests for loot and gold have made men greedy. Gunfights, murders, and death from starvation have left many dead on the barren desert trails. Their ghosts still walk the mountain ridges, gullies, and deserted locations they once traveled or lived, spirits with unfinished business who cannot rest. Some guard buried treasures and lost mines, while others battle perpetually until death, forever replaying their last moments of life," Cactus Jim wrote. So here are a few of the most haunting tales in that region, adapted from Desert USA and the Paranormal Blogspot.
In the 1860s, when stage coaches were the primary means of cross-country travel, a special stage set out from El Paso, headed for San Diego with a box of coins. The stage that carried the coins had one driver and a guard. When the stage reached Yuma, Arizona, the guard fell ill and the driver continued on without him. That same stage was held up by robbers somewhere in the area where the route meanders into Carrizo Wash in East County's desert region between the Fish and the Coyote Mountains. The driver was shot during the robbery and the thieves stashed the coins in the south slope of Fish Mountain. The coins remain there to this day, they say, because there were too many soldiers passing by on the trail for the bandits to retrieve their loot. It is said that after the robbery, the dead driver and the stage continued through Carrizo, and after that, the stage disappeared, never to be seen again, at least not in an earthly form. But some witnesses say that the phantom stage still forges its way through the deep sand, pulled by a team of four mules on moonlit nights. The phantom stage is driven by a lone driver hunched over as if asleep. No passengers are seen on the stage when it passes through Carrizo Wash, hesitating only a moment, as if planning to stop where the Carrizo station once stood, though it's now only a pile of mud. The phantom stage continues on past the old station until out of sight. In the morning, you may think twice about whether you actually saw the phantom stage until you find ruts carved from wagon wheels and fresh hoof prints left behind by the ghostly stage that travels on occasion as if to keep the trail alive.
Vallecito is known for its ghost. Its history contains many murders, deaths, robberies, and other wicked tales. One well-known story involves a double murder at Vallecito Station. It all started with a stage holdup in which $65,000 worth of loot was stolen by four men on horseback who robbed the eastbound stage before reached Carrizo Wash en route to Vallecito Station. As the men fled the scene, the driver of the stage fired one shot, killing one of the four men. When he reached the thief he had shot, he found not one, but two dead bodies. The driver concluded that the leader of the band of thieves had shot one of his own men, so he would not have to divide up the loot. The bandit leader and one of the thief survived the robbery and buried their loot in nearby hills, then rode on to Vallecito Station for a drink and some food. But the two bandits began to argue while having a drink. The leader of the outlaws went outside to check on his horse, promising to continue the discussion when he returned. He did return, entering through the doorway, mounted on his big white horse, and he shot his companion. As the wounded bandit was dying, he drew his gun and fired back at the leader, killing him off the back of his brave white horse. The white stallion, spooked by the gunfire and death of his master, ran off into the hills. It is said that when someone is in the valley, around midnight, near where the bandits buried their loot, the ghost of a white horse will appear from nowhere, galloping through the sand and then disappearing without a trace.
If you find yourself out late in the desert night, somewhere between the Superstition Mountains and the 17 Palms, you may see the apparition of an 8-foot glowing skeleton. A prospector by the name of Charlie Arizona first saw the ghost about 4 miles southeast of Borrego. It was a dark night when Charlie set up for camp. Just as he was settling down for the night, something disturbed his burrows. Hearing the frightened braying, he went to investigate. A shadow loomed large. Suddenly, he saw a large human skeleton with a lantern light shining right through its ribs. The skeleton walked in a crazy fashion, as if looking for something or as if it were lost. Heart pounded, Charlie watched, transfixed as the skeleton disappeared over the ridge. About 2 years later, two prospectors camping in Superstition Mountains caught sight of the flickering light in the distance and wondered what it was, but it quickly disappeared. One of the prospectors thought it looked like a skeleton carrying a lantern, but they figured it was just the fire reflecting off a rock. The two prospectors didn't think much of the incident until a year later, when a traveler came into the Vallecito station with the tail of a skeleton he saw wandering in the desert carrying a light. It wasn't long before the news of the skeleton got around, and two adventurers went out into the desert to search for this legendary skeleton ghost. During their third night in the desert, they encountered the ghastly lit skeleton. One of the men shot at it with a gun, but the skeleton continued on, unfazed by the gunfire. The two men followed the skeleton for 3 miles as it wandered in a strange and intermittent gait, over ridges and through valleys, before they lost track of it. Many believe that the skeleton is the ghost of a prospector who discovered and worked the Phantom Mine, which has been lost for many years. The skeleton is no better off than the rest of us, for he continues to search for the lost Phantom Mine, wandering the dark desert nights looking for his final resting place.
Not far from the Phantom Mine lies another place where skeletons have been seen. During warm summer nights, when the moon is full, ghosts dance at Yaqui Well. The ghosts are said to be the spirits of 3 emigrants who were traveling from Yuma to California. In search of a shorter route through the desert, the emigrants arrived at Yaqui Well, exhausted and near death from lack of food and water. One of the 3 travelers drank from the well as much water as he could hold. He died shortly thereafter. The other 2 men also drank from the well, but survived. While moving their dead companion's body, the other 2 noticed some rock specimens that fell out of his pocket. The 2 men were excited to discover the rocks contained gold, but they did not know where their friend had found the samples. Their excitement about the gold turned into greed and distrust. The 2 men began to struggle until one finally drowned the other in the muddy water of Yaqui Well. An Indian watched these events unfold from a nearby hill. He tried to talk to the man who had survived, but the emigrant was still so excited as he told his story that he entered a state of frenzy and ran off into the desert yelling, "Gold! Gold!" It is only during the hot summer nights of the full moon that the 3 emigrants return to Yaqui Well. One rises out of the muddy waters of the Yaqui Well. One emerges from the brush nearby, and the 3rd arrives in the cool breeze out of the wash. The ghosts join hands and circle Yaqui Well in a dance. Soon after the twirling begins, they disappear, leaving only the good waters of the well and a slight chill in the air.
In the 1800s, many stories began circulating about a ship lying half buried in the sands of the Anza Borrego Desert, and some say its spectral sails unfurl at times on a ghostly voyage, its phantom crew seeking their way back home. After the Civil War, many migrants who passed through the desert on their way to California reported seeing a Spanish galleon with multiple masts and swore this was no mirage. Most claimed that it was loaded with a fortune's worth of exquisite pearls. Many expeditions sought to retrieve these riches, but so far, none have succeeded. As the story goes, in 1610, King Philip III of Spain ordered Alvarez de Cordone to search off Mexico's coast and bring back pearls. Cordone hired 2 other captains, Juan de Iturbe and Pedro de Rosales. He also hired 60 pearl divers and had 3 ships built. In 1612, they set sail to plunder Mexico's west coast of its precious oysters. The ship paused repeatedly in its travels so that pearl divers could jump off and return with oysters they discovered on the ocean floor. Later, they found a village where Native Americans had baskets of pearls just lying about. The Spaniards arranged a trade of their fancy European clothing for the pearls, but instead swindled the Native Americans by giving them only rags and dirty cloths. Outraged, the Indians attacked the ship as it was trying to set sail. Cordone was hit by an arrow, and his ship was forced to turn around. But he ordered the other 2 ships on in the search of more pearls, commanding them to look north in the Gulf of California. As they journeyed up the Gulf, Rosales' ship struck a reef in a terrible storm. Before it sank, the crew transferred the valuable cargo to Iturbe's vessel, which sailed up the Gulf and eventually up the Colorado River and into the Salton Sea, or Lake Cahuilla, as it may have been called long ago. Some stories claim that the ship sailed into the Salton Sea to find the legendary Straits of Anian, an all-water route from the Gulf of California to the Gulf of Mexico. It's been said that the Salton Sea and the Colorado River ran high, filled with water during a flood that swept the ship into the vast inland sea. Some say that an earthquake happened, closing off escape. The captain was horrified to find the outlet to the ocean blocked. Water in the lake was swiftly evaporating. Soon the ship was beached on the California desert, many miles from the sea. The crew grabbed what few supplies they could carry and abandoned ship, trudging westwards toward the water. As the story goes, the survivors were finally picked up. Other versions of the tale involve a pirate ship loaded down with almost 1 million doubloons. Another story states that the ship was from King Solomon's Navy, carrying the 10 lost tribes of Israel to North America. Another variation on this story claims that the Kaweah Indians, knowing the Spanish were coming to take their riches and harm them, ambushed the Spanish party that came ashore. Then the tribe mounted a full attack on the galleon and after a fierce battle annihilated the entire crew. The Kaweahs began looting the ship of food and exotic items, but they could not move nor break into the heavy large iron chests in the hold. Then a storm brewed up, dousing the galleon. The Native Americans were forced to desert the ship, which broke from its anchor, drifted off into the storm, and sunk into the inland sea, taking its precious cargo with it. By the time the lake dried up years later, the ship had been long buried under tons of dirt, sand, and silt. How true could these stories be? Lake Kaweah did exist in the 16th century and had a tribe of Native Americans living nearby. It is possible that a flood occurred connecting the Salton Sea to the Gulf of California. The area between the desert and the Gulf has the potential to be hit with massive flooding, as we know from Hurricane Kathleen in the 1970s, which sent a 10-foot high wall of water across the desert floor. So yes, it is plausible a ship could have been carried in on the surge and stranded afterwards as water receded. The sheer number of stories told by both Native Americans and frontiersmen through the centuries suggests some truth to these lost ship tales. Expeditions in search of the lost treasure ship began in the 1800s, after travelers heard tales from Native Americans. Some claimed that the ship seen in the desert was haunted and could only be found at certain times of the year. In 1870, several Indians reported seeing the ship west of Dos Palmas. Later that year, the Los Angeles Star published a series of short stories about Charlie Klusker, who claimed to have located the ship and its broken masts. He was organizing expeditions to bring back the missing vessel, which he claimed was filled with crosses. It was reportedly 50 miles from Dos Palmas in a region of boiling mud springs. But there were no further updates, and Mr. Klusker appears to have simply disappeared, much like the elusive ship. In 1878, three German prospectors said they saw the ship around sundown, about 120 miles northwest of Yuma and 40 miles east of Indio. The sighting actually cost one of the prospectors their lives. The two survivors reported seeing an immense ship under full sail floating over the desert, sailing like a cloud into the sunset. The prospector who died went after it in the next morning, but never returned. A rescue party eventually found him dead from a lack of water, and strangely, he was completely nude. In 1905, a prospector named Butcherknife Ike claimed to have discovered a fossil ship buried in the sand dunes of Borrego Springs. And in 1915, a Yuma Indian arrived in one town paying for his merchandise with pearls. When questioned, he claimed to have spent the night in a strangely shaped wooden house that was partially covered by sand. The people he spoke to offered him several hundreds of dollars for the night if he would take them back there in the morning, but he vanished overnight with their money. In 1933, Antonio de Fierro Blanco wrote a book discussing the story of Tiburcio Mancerna, a young mule driver who claimed he came across the lost Spanish galleon way back in 1775. Back then, Tiburcio was a mule driver for explorer Juan Bautista de Anza, who was searching for a land route from Sonora to Alta California. The young mule driver said he went into the hold of the ship and actually saw a treasure trove of pearls, but was never able to relocate the evasive ship. Many treasure hunters have gone after the missing treasure of pearls, but none have brought back evidence of finding it. Perhaps because these are simply tall tales, or perhaps because the shifting sands of the desert at times reveal and at other times obscure the legendary lost ship. According to some storytellers, the ship itself, now bleached white and desiccated by the whipping sands, blown by the desert winds, has become a ghost. If you're out in the desert late some night, you may just see an eerie otherworldly glow and hear the singing of those long-dead sailors, the skeleton of a ghost ship sailing into the sunset or adrift in the moonlight. Is the mysterious ship laden with the fortune and pearls still out there in the desert? Perhaps sailing spectrally over the sands? Perhaps one day, when the sands blow the right way, we'll be lucky enough to find out.
Now we have one last hair-raising tale to tell, and this one is about the mysterious giant black cats reported to be prowling the wilds of East County. A reader tells us that sightings of huge black cats the size of mountain lions or bigger date back at least to the 1980s, when witnesses described a black cougar near Highway 67 at the eastern end of Poway. Zoology experts claim there is no such thing as a black cougar or mountain lion, though they once said the same thing about black bobcats, until one was killed by a car and proof positive was found that these once legendary animals existed. Another possibility is a black leopard, an exotic pet that's escaped. But a more likely explanation for the many sightings here is that there are black jaguars in northern Mexico, big cats that when fully grown can be much larger than mountain lions. An adult male can weigh up to 350 pounds, though females can be about the size of mountain lions and cubs even smaller. Jaguars have golden eyes, squared heads, and very powerful jaws capable of taking down a full-sized crocodile in the wild. Officially, jaguars have been extinct in California for decades. But have they returned? Or perhaps they never really left. Yet another possibility is that jaguars have bred with mountain lions. That, too, is thought to be impossible, scientists say, but they once thought wolves could not breed with coyotes, until DNA testing proved that they did, and frequently. Many of the early sightings in San Diego County of large black wildcats have been made close to the border, some very near a gap in the border fence in Hukumba Hot Springs, where the terrain was too rugged to connect the fence up. Howard Cook, the former head of Hukumba's planning group, told me there have been regular sightings in recent years of a big black cat believed to be a jaguar, and also what appears to be a golden black spotted jaguar at Lake Hukumba. Such a pair could give birth to cubs that could be either black or spotted. He believes the big cats crossed over from Mexico, and the town librarian's son also saw what he described as a black panther crossing Old Highway 80 and Boulevard some years ago, though there's technically no such thing as a black panther either, a term used by ordinary folks to describe any of several big black cats. Gene Garrity told us that he and a friend, both farm boys, were out hunting above Loveland Reservoir south of Alpine back in 1994 when a huge black cat crossed the road in front of them. The tail was very fat and very long, he said. We got out of my Jeep, and we were looking at the paw prints in the mud. They were huge, with very huge claw marks. I estimate the cat was close to 200 pounds or more, he said. Assistant Border Patrol Chief Rosario Pete Vasquez told me, I saw one on Mount Laguna maybe 20 years ago. It was daytime, and there was snow on the ground, so you could definitely tell it was all black. That big cat weighed about 100 pounds, he estimated. One winter night in 2011, the reader reported that a resident of Hapatool Valley, south of Alpine, Warren Storm Thunder, claimed he saw a jaguarundi, a black cat from central Mexico that is a little smaller than a mountain lion. Sharon Cremosis, a rancher and a friend of mine, insists she saw a large black wild cat slightly smaller than a mountain lion while driving her golf cart on a ranch she owned in a remote area of Boulevard near the border. A neighbor of hers has also seen black wild cats, she told us, and she's also seen mountain lions and is confident in her description. Ariel Brooke, one of our very own writers, who is also a teacher, saw a large black cat running across a roadway in Deerhorn Valley about a year ago. It looked like a black mountain lion and moved like a wild animal, she said, adding it had a long cat-like tail. In 2012, a resident of Aguanga near Warner Springs at the base of Cahuilla Mountain reported she heard her dogs going ballistic and walked outside to see a huge black cat perched on a boulder near her barn, which had a pig, a goat, and horses stabled inside. She said the cat was creeping up the rocks and had glistening circles of gray on its black fur. It was smaller than a mountain lion, and it sounds to us like a black jaguar cub, which can have spots faintly visible. On a blog post, she wrote that neighbors saw the same thing. And the Union Tribune published a report in December 2013 of a couple near Miramar Reservoir who claimed to see a large gray-black cat about 4.5 feet long that swiftly vanished into brush on a steep hill above the water. There have been many sightings locally, though none have been documented with photos, perhaps because these mysterious creatures move swiftly and are often spotted at night, Plus, frightened observers may be more concerned with not becoming dinner than with snapping a photo. We first reported on these mysterious black cat sightings back in 2014, and our readers deluged us with their tales. A reader in the Anza area, in the northeast part of our county, says there were several sightings in 2014 in her area as well. A Pine Valley reader said she was putting out food for a small feral cat in her gazebo one night when she was startled to see what looked like a panther with an unusually strong build, a big head and coal black fur that she believes was a jaguar. "I sure froze in my tracks," she told us, adding that she slowly backed up to her door just as the cat dug in its claws into the carpeting on the gazebo she'd been standing on a moment earlier and pulled up the carpet off the cement. On September 1st, that's just last month, Forest Service volunteers Peter and Chris Ruth wrote to warn us that hikers saw a large animal resembling a big black cat in a tree near Cedar Creek Falls in the Julian area, a popular hiking destination. Soon after, two women volunteers hiking the trail to pick up trash heard growling noises three times and promptly exited the area. Were those black jaguars? Or possibly black bears? Another species thought to be extinct here that have since been documented to have returned, though still rare. In 2013, a Border Patrol camera caught proof positive on an infrared camera in Inkapa where a black bear ran across the road. But the big black cat sighting at Cedar Creek Falls becomes more plausible given a second big black cat sighting reported on October 26th, just days ago, to our news publication by Cameron Forbes, who says he and his son saw a giant black cat walking past a campground in broad daylight at Pines Anita in the Julian area, the size of a mountain lion or even bigger. These huge black predatory cats have also been seen in Spring Valley. Last year, a retired U.S. Navy chief, Manuel Domingsong, said he heard his chickens making noise and he went out to find a giant black cat inside the coop. It killed a chicken that night, and at 5 a.m. the next morning, he went out to check his coop and found the black cat back inside, and the rest of his chickens were dead. The large cat leaped over a fence right in front of him. 2 months later, a college professor, Dan Moody, told us that his mother, Dee Moody, a retired high school teacher, saw a jet black big cat weighing at least 70 pounds that sauntered across an open field beside her Spring Valley house in broad daylight. She described it as black and shiny, with a tail at least half as long as its body. And then on Christmas Day last year, a retired professor came across two dead coyotes at the end of her cul-de-sac on the eastern side of Dictionary Hill in Spring Valley. Their throats had been slashed, and the bodies were still warm. Only a very large predator, likely a huge cat, could have killed coyotes, which are themselves a predatory species. We do have coyotes across East County, and you may hear their mournful howls at night. But if you're walking out in the dark in East County, and you happen to catch a glimpse of a huge black shadowy cat, or hear the growl of a large animal, remember the sage advice of poet Ogden Nash, who wrote, "When called by a panther, don't anther."
We hope you've enjoyed these haunting tales from East County. We extend our special thanks to the participants in today's special presentation: Miriam Raftery, Leon Thompson, Devario Bell, Tasha Matthews, Liz Alper, and this is Ed Barena. From all of us at East County Magazine and KNSJ Radio, to all of you, our listeners, we wish you a chilling and thrilling Halloween. Happy haunting!
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine Radio Show or get involved as a volunteer, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.